Researchers have found a way into our dreams. I find this absolutely fascinating. Scientists at Northwestern University, as well as elsewhere in the world, have jointly released a study showing that they were able to communicate with individuals during REM sleep, that deep stage of sleep. Researchers were able to ask participants simple questions during the study, and some of the participants were able to give answers through a sequence of eye movements or by contracting their face muscles. So they didn't come out of sleep. They stayed asleep and were able to respond to the prompt. Question is, what are the implications from this? Joining us is Ken Paller, one of the senior authors of the study. He's professor of psychology and director of Northwestern's Cognitive Neuroscience Program. Thank you so much, Professor Paller, for being with us today on Air Talk.
Thank you, Larry. Glad to be with you.
So describe a bit more about this study and how it was set up with the test subjects.
Well, people come into the laboratory and they sleep in a very special room that's equipped with monitoring devices, so we can monitor their brain activity and their eye movements and their muscle activity, and therefore verify whether they're asleep and determine what stage they're in. And our broader goals are to understand things like, why do we sleep? Why do we dream? And what relevance does it have for our waking activity, such as our memory function? And in this case, we wanted to find out more about dreams, not just by asking people what they dreamt about when they wake up, but being able to ask them during their dream what's happening. Because as you know, when you wake up, you quickly forget what happened in the dream. And even the things you do remember, sometimes it's distorted. It's not necessarily quite what happened or in the right order, or you're not even sure did it happen 10 seconds ago, or was that something from earlier in the evening?
There's
so we need more data. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, there's that Seinfeld episode where he's trying to remember his dreams and it's like brilliant, thinks he's having these brilliant breakthroughs. It's just gibberish in the morning. And I think for many of us, we have that experience. We think it's some great profound dream or something that's so funny that we dream. And then if we're fortunate enough to remember the dream in the morning, it has none of the impact it did when we were asleep.
But there are a lot of stories of people coming up with actual insights in their dreams. And, you know, Paul McCartney writing a song, or very scientists coming up with ideas. So there's interesting evidence for the creativity of dreams actually informing us once we wake up and making sense in some cases.
Do we understand why some people have lucid dreams where they're fully asleep, in deep sleep, they're dreaming, but know they're dreaming, versus the vast majority of dreams where there's no understanding that it's a dream as it's being dreamed?
Yeah, that's an interesting distinction. And some people just come naturally to have lucid dreams, maybe when they were a child and they were having nightmares. Other people learn to develop ability because it's a skill and you can get better at it by practicing. You have to practice remembering your dreams when you wake up and then remembering to check every given moment to see if you're dreaming at the moment or awake, and eventually making the insight that you're having a dream and therefore you're in a lucid dream. But in our research, we've also been pushing on some ways to make this more easy for people, to provoke them into this lucid dreaming state. And that's what we did with some of our subjects in these experiments.
What were the questions you asked the subjects to see if you'd get a response once they were in the REM state?
Well, in this paper, we want to understand about dreams, but first we wanted to ask questions where we knew what the answer was. And in that way, we could assess whether we were communicating accurately, whether they were understanding us and communicating back correctly. So we relied on questions like math problems, like 8 minus 6. And if we asked a question like that and they answered with the correct answer, we could then infer that we were communicating. And that'll allow us to move on to ask more questions about what are they actually dreaming about? What's their experience? And then we can ask, how does that relate to the brain activity at that time? How does that relate to whether their heart rate's going up or not? And this will give us more insights into dreams. But for now, it was just this question. We didn't know, would communication really work? Because we thought perhaps they would hear the question in some distorted fashion in their dream and not be able to answer the question correctly because they hear something entirely different. But to our glee, we found that people could understand lots of the questions and often answer correctly. So,
and you checked this multiple times. We just want to, because it wasn't like someone twitches their eye twice and then, oh, they answered the question. You asked the question again to double check the response to make sure it was intentional.
Yes, and we also observed this in multiple people and in multiple labs. My colleagues in France and Germany and the Netherlands did similar experiments and also found correct communication. So yes, it was enough repetitions of this that we can conclude that it wasn't just a fluke. And, you know, in REM sleep, there are always eye movements, you know, kind of moving around your eyes as you're moving around in your dream. But the signals we got were quite distinctive. So we have pretty good confidence that they weren't just chance signals, but people are actually hearing the questions. And then, of course, when we had people wake up and ask them about their dreams, they often told us, well, I was in a room somewhere. Like one student, she said, oh, I was in my math class and these questions were coming up, math questions were coming up. And I knew they were from, you know, Karen coming from the outside in the experiments because I knew I was in a dream. So I answered them with the eye signals and she could, you know, confirm that, in fact, what we had recorded at the time was also what she remembered when she woke up.
So she remembered accurately that she was in this sleep test, that she was being asked the question externally by a researcher, by a staffer, and that she was having the dream about being in math class concurrently. That was all known.
That's right, Larry. And another important thing is we also had to confirm that she was in REM sleep. So we're looking at the electrical recordings, verifying that she's in this state of sleep we call REM. And one of the features of REM is muscle paralysis. So we look at EMG recordings, we can see really low muscle activity. And that means she can't really move. She can't talk to us. She can't answer because in REM sleep, you're not able to move your muscles much at all, but you're able to move your eyes freely. And so we had them answer with their eyes. Basically, if you're in a dream and you think, oh, I'm going to move my eyes all the way to the left and to the right and repeat that, your actual eyes are also moving. And that's what we're measuring for the signals when she's replying to questions.
We're talking with Northwestern University professor Ken Paller. He's professor of psychology and directs Northwestern's cognitive neuroscience program. He's one of the senior authors on what's an international study on communicating with lucid dreamers while they're in deep sleep, REM sleep. And this was not the majority of people in the study, we should mention, but there were certainly people, and this was multiple locations, right, who were able to communicate?
Yes, our colleagues in Paris and in Germany and the Netherlands did similar experiments with their participants and confirmed basically the same kind of results that communication can happen. It doesn't always happen. You know, people come to the laboratory, they might not even fall asleep. But if they do fall asleep, sometimes they also get into REM sleep. And then if they're in REM sleep, sometimes they have a lucid dream, sometimes provoked by us playing particular sounds that help them get into this lucid dream state. And then they also have to kind of be attentive enough to hear our questions and then answer them. So often they didn't seem to hear the questions and we didn't get an answer, but we did get answers often enough for us to have confidence in those results.
Ken, what are the implications of this? I'm thinking, example, about sleep behaviors that people have from sleepwalking or teeth grinding or, you know, all kinds of things that we don't necessarily understand all that well. Night terrors are, you know, concern for some people. Can this give us insight ultimately about that?
Yeah, that's new territory we have to look at. You know, some of the phenomena you mentioned aren't actually REM sleep phenomena. They're happening in different stages, perhaps when people aren't sort of open to having a dream and having us interrupt their dream with our questions. But we need to look at that. I think there are a number of implications for different disorders. Also thinking about things like PTSD and depression, these disorders have components of sleep problems with them. And one always wonders, well, is that another symptom of the disorder or is that part of the cause? And if it's part of the cause, it could be that we could change sleep a little bit and produce better outcomes for people if we can perhaps have them in the case of PTSD, work with the memory that's troubling them from some trauma. If they can work that through in a different way, that might be helpful. But we still have to understand a lot about how that works. So, you know, the starting implication is now we can ask some different questions about sleep and about dreaming with this additional evidence in real time about what they're dreaming about, to kind of add to the various sources of evidence we use to try to understand what the brain's doing during sleep. Because, you know, yeah, the brain is so busy during sleep. It's not like you turn your brain off.
I thought
it's
we were active. Resting it.
Yeah, you would think so. And it's actually quite busy and doing, you know, in different stages of sleep. We have a stage called slow wave sleep that's different from REM sleep. And these stages are important times for memory processing, because one of the, you know, sleep is so important in so many ways, and not just for feeling well rested, but another thing that it helps us with is our memory function, to be able to learn things and remember them and have them available later. Sleep seems to contribute to that. And so that's one of the big things we've been investigating and trying to understand, what sleep contributes to our ability to remember and perhaps to our ability to solve problems and be creative. These are all sort of related functions that might relate to what our brains are doing during the night. And we, you know, right now we can look and say, well, how many hours did you sleep in? How much slow wave sleep did you get? But we also need to look at, and what was happening in your mind during those periods? What kind of memories were you bringing up? And are you recycling negative thoughts during your sleep? Or can we make your sleep kind of go to a calmer, better place that might lead you to feel better when you wake up the next day?
Well, and you just anticipated where I was going, because I was going to follow up. So many people use music or, you know, recordings of different types with positive messages, things as they fall asleep to try and put them in a better state of mind, to have a more restful sleep. But I wonder if your research gives us a clue about how we could go even more deeply to sort of implant positive things into our brains as we go into sleep.
Yeah, you know, it's sort of been an urban legend that you can't learn things during sleep. There's no real shortcut where you could master some foreign language during your sleep. And that sort of has been around for like 50, 60 years that we've been poo-pooing that kind of work. But now we're going back to it and saying, well, yes, you don't magically acquire memories during sleep, but it is an important time for brain processing, and you can push it around depending on what's happening, including, as you mentioned, your intentions before going to sleep, and also sounds that remind you of particular things while you are asleep can have an impact. And so a lot more work is needed to ask those questions again and ask, well, what benefits are possible by changing how we sleep in these more subtle ways, in addition to all the standard things. Of course, sleep hygiene is important, getting enough sleep, not having screens too late at night, not having too much caffeine, and, you know, all the things you want to do to get a good night's sleep, in addition to looking at, well, what is the full way of thinking about the quality of sleep that's going to help you do better the next day.
Ken Paller, thank you so much for talking with us about this fascinating area of research. I'm sure when people find out what you do professionally, they want to learn all about it, as we did today. So thank you for talking about what you're doing in your lab.
Thank you so much, Larry.
He's director of Northwestern University's Cognitive Neuroscience Program, professor of psychology, and one of the senior authors of this study recently published in the journal Current Biology. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Coming up, we'll talk with University of Michigan experimental psychology professor Ethan Cross. His new book, Chatter, The Voice in Our Head, Why It Matters, and How to Harness It. Find out how to deal with that troll that's talking with you inside. We'll be back in just 90 seconds.